Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something that honestly feels a bit murky for a lot of people, investment banks. Specifically, how do these giants actually make their money?
Right. It's a great question because, you know, your everyday bank, the one on the corner, straightforward. Deposits, loans, interest rates, pretty clear.
Exactly. But these massive institutions handling IPOs, huge global mergers, government debt, it feels like a totally different universe, almost like a black box.
It can feel that way. They operate on a different scale with different clients and, crucially, different ways of generating income.
So our mission today is to kind of pry open that box, give you, our listeners, a shortcut to understanding these places that are so central to how markets work, but often seem so opaque. Mm-hmm. We've looked at sources breaking down their main revenue streams, the big four, really, mm-hmm. and we want to show why their profit engine is, well, fundamentally different from the bank you use every day.
That's the core of it.
Okay, let's unpack this business model.
So, to get where the money comes from, you first have to grasp their basic role.
Yeah.
Investment banks are fundamentally middlemen. Essential middlemen, actually, in the global financial system.
Middlemen, but not for everyday folks.
No, not at all. They're not interested in your checking account or, you know, a small business loan. They connect entities that need huge amounts of capital. Think of big corporations, governments, with those who have large institutional investors, pension funds, that sort of thing.
So they're kind of market architects, funding massive projects, guiding how companies grow or merge.
Precisely. They shape markets, finance major infrastructure, steer corporate strategy through really complex deals. That's their playground.
Okay, so if my local bank is like the utility company Reliable, basic services, the investment bank is more like a specialist engineering firm, but for global money flows. High-end bespoke.
That's a good analogy, and their income reflects that. It's not primarily built on the slow, steady interest earned from loans. It's built on substantial fees for complex services and direct participation in the markets.
Which brings us to those four core functions you mentioned. That's where the revenue really comes from, right?
Exactly. Almost all their significant income flows from these four pillars. First, underwriting. Second, advisory services, think M&A. Third, trading and market making. And fourth, asset management.
Underwriting, advisory, trading, asset management. Got it. And the key difference, again, is fees and trading profits versus the interest income commercial banks rely on.
Absolutely key.
Okay, let's get into the specifics then. How do they actually put a price tag on these things? Because understanding these streams, that's how you grasp the scale and maybe the volatility of their earnings. So let's talk brass tacks. What are we looking at fee-wise?
Well, let's start with underwriting fees. This is what happens when a company wants to go public in IPO or issue a large amount of bonds.
Right, raising serious cash.
Serious cash. The investment bank steps in, essentially agrees to buy the entire batch of new stocks or bonds from the company.
Wow. Okay, they buy it all up front.
Typically, yes, in a firm commitment underwriting. And then they take on the job and the risk of reselling those securities to investors in the market.
Okay, so they're taking on massive risk there. If the market suddenly tanks, or nobody wants those shares, they're stuck with them.
That's the risk. And that risk is precisely why they can charge a substantial fee. They're guaranteeing the capital raise for the client.
And that guarantee comes at a premium. I imagine for a multi-billion-dollar offering, that fee could be huge.
It can be.
Yeah.
We've seen sources mention fees maybe as low as, say, 1% for very large stable debt deals. But for something riskier, like a tech company IPO with lots of uncertainty, that fee could easily jump up to maybe 5, 6, even 7% of the total amount raised.
7%. So on a billion-dollar IPO, that's $70 million just for managing that one sale.
Potentially, yes.
Hmm.
A single transaction can absolutely net the bank tens, even hundreds of millions in fees because they absorb that initial placement risk.
Okay, wow. That's stream one, underwriting. What's next? Advisory.
Stream two. Advisory services. This is where you hear about the big headline-grabbing mergers and acquisitions, M&A, or complex corporate restructuring.
The strategic side.
Exactly. This is more about brain power, strategy, connections. The fee here isn't really tied to taking on capital risk, like underwriting. It's tied to their expertise, their negotiation skills, their ability to value companies accurately, and maybe most importantly, their access.
Access, meaning knowing who to call.
Knowing exactly who to call. If you want to sell your multi-billion dollar company, the investment bank knows the perhaps handful of potential buyers globally who could actually do that deal. They have the relationships. They can make the introductions, structure the deal, navigate the complexity.
So that insight, that network, plus the complex financial modeling and negotiation. that's what justifies those multi-million dollar advisory fees, which I guess are often success-based.
Often, yes. A percentage of the final deal value is common. So the bigger the deal, the bigger the fee. It's payment for strategic guidance and execution on deals that can reshape entire industries.
Okay. Underwriting fees based on risk, advisory fees based on expertise and access. What's stream three?
Stream three is trading profits. And this is where things can get really dynamic and volatile.
Ah, the trading floor image comes to mind. Lots of screens, lots of shouting.
Maybe less shouting these days, more algorithms. But yes, that's the area. They do two main things here. First, they trade on behalf of clients. Mm-hmm. So a big pension fund wants to buy $1 billion of bonds. The IB executes that trade. That's client business.
And they provide liquidity doing that, right? Matching buyers and sellers, making the market work.
Correct. That's called market making. It's an essential function, providing liquidity so others can trade easily. They might make a small profit on the spread, the difference between the buying and selling price.
Okay, that sounds relatively straightforward, but you said there were two things.
The second part is the more, shall we say, high stakes one, proprietary trading or prop trading.
Meaning they trade with the bank's own money.
Exactly. Using the bank's own capital to make bets on which way markets, stocks, bonds, currencies, commodities are going to move.
That sounds risky.
Extremely. It's probably the highest leverage, highest risk activity they engage in. Get the bet right, and you can make enormous profits very quickly. Get it wrong.
And the losses can be just as enormous and just as quick.
Precisely. This is the area that caused a lot of trouble back in 2008 and has faced much more regulation since. But it can still be a significant source of profit and potential loss.
Okay, so high risk, high reward trading. Got it. That leaves the fourth stream.
The fourth pillar is asset management. And this one is quite different from the others. It's generally seen as the more stable, steady part of the business.
Ah, stability. Something banks probably crave given the volatility of the other streams.
Definitely. Here, the bank isn't structuring a deal or making a short-term trade. They're managing large pools of money over the long term for their clients.
Who are the clients here? Still big institutions?
Big institutions. Yes, pension funds, endowments, sovereign wealth funds, but also very high net worth individuals and families. Managing their wealth, their investments.
And how do they make money doing that? Is it transaction fees again?
Primarily, no. The main revenue model here is charging ongoing management fees. It's usually calculated as a percentage of the total assets under management, or AUM.
AUM. Okay, so if they're managing, say, $100 billion for various clients.
They might charge a small annual percentage on that total amount. Maybe 0.5%, 1%, sometimes more, depending on the strategy.
But even 0.5% of $100 billion is, what, $500 million per year?
Exactly. And the top banks manage trillions in assets. So even a tiny percentage generates a very large, very stable, and predictable stream of recurring income.
Recurring income. That's the magic phrase, isn't it? It helps smooth out the feast or famine nature of the deal-making side, the underwriting and advisory stuff.
Absolutely. It's the ballast for the ship. It provides a foundation of earnings, regardless of whether the M&A market is hot or cold that year.
So those are the big four. Underwriting, advisory, trading, and asset management. Are there other smaller bits?
Yes, there are definitely other contributors. Things like commissions on brokerage services, fees for research reports they sell to investors, and income from creating and selling complex financial products. Like derivatives.
Derivatives. Those are like financial contracts based on the future price of something else, right? Hedging tools or speculative bets.
Essentially, yes. They can be used for risk management or speculation. They're complex, but they add another, albeit smaller, layer to the bank's overall profitability. But those four main pillars are really the engines.
Okay, that paints a much clearer picture of the how. Now, maybe contrasting this directly with the commercial banks we know really drives home the difference in their nature.
Yes, I think that comparison is really useful because the differences are stark. Clients, revenue models, risk levels, It's all different.
So commercial banks are familiar local branches. Their bread and butter is taking deposits from people like us and making loans, mortgages, car loans, small business loans.
Right. And their main profit comes from the spread, the difference between the interest they earn on those loans and the interest they pay out on deposits.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, account fees, credit card fees is generally lower risk, focused on volume and stability.
They serve the general public, small businesses. Their risk is managed through things like diversification of loans and deposit insurance.
Correct. Now, investment banks, completely different client base. Large corporations, governments, massive institutional investors. No retail customers walking in off the street.
And their revenue, as we just discussed, comes almost entirely from those hefty fees for underwriting and advisory, plus the profits and potential losses from trading. Asset management fees provide stability, but the core deal-making is very market-dependent.
Which means their profitability is much more closely tied to the overall health and, frankly, the mood of the global economy and the financial markets. When markets are booming, they can make incredible amounts of money. When things slow down,
their main income streams can dry up fast.
Exactly. Much higher risk profile, much higher potential reward, much more volatility.
And this difference even extends to who regulates them, right?
Yes, fundamentally. Commercial banks, because they handle public deposits, are overseen by banking regulators like the Fed or the FDIC in the U.S., focused on solvency and protecting depositors. Investment banks, dealing primarily in securities, M&A, and market activities, fall mainly under the purview of securities regulators like the SEC.
Different regulators for different kinds of risks and activities. They really do operate in separate, though connected, financial ecosystems.
Absolutely. Two different worlds.
So speaking of that high-risk, high-reward world, we have to talk about the fragility. Those huge earnings we hear about. They aren't guaranteed. They can vanish pretty quickly.
Oh, absolutely. The potential for massive profits comes hand-in-hand with significant risks. Things can go wrong fast.
When you look at the potential threats, what stands out? What keeps investment bankers up at night? I'd guess market downturns are number one.
Definitely. Market volatility or a general economic slowdown is a huge threat. Investment banks thrive on activity companies issuing stock, buying each other, investors trading actively. If fear takes over or the economy stalls,
everything just freezes. Companies pause IPO plans, hold off on big acquisitions.
Precisely. The pipeline for those big underwriting and advisory fees just shuts down almost overnight. That's a direct hit to their main revenue sources.
Okay, market risk. What else? Regulation must be a big one, especially after 2008.
Constant pressure. The post-crisis reforms, like the Volcker Rule in the U.S., specifically aimed at limiting risky activities, particularly proprietary trading.
So the rules made the system safer, which was the goal.
Yes, undoubtedly safer. But they also directly capped some of the potential upside profits the banks could make from betting their own capital. It constrained one of their most lucrative, albeit riskiest, activities. So it's an ongoing tension between safety and profitability.
Makes sense. Threat number three, maybe, reputation.
Right. Huge. Reputation and the related risk of litigation. Investment banking operates on trust and relationships, especially at the highest levels.
Yeah.
A major scandal, a deal gone bad that leads to lawsuits, accusations of misconduct.
That can be incredibly costly, right? Not just in fines, but in lost business.
Absolutely devastating. We've seen global banks hit with billions, literally billions in fines for various issues over the years. That directly wipes out profits. And perhaps worse, it damages client trust, which can take years, if ever, to rebuild. Future deals might go to competitors.
So market risk, regulatory risk, reputation risk. What's the fourth major one?
Just the overall economic cycle. It ties back to market risk, but it's broader. Investment banking is inherently cyclical. They do exceptionally well during economic booms when confidence is high, capital is flowing, and companies are expanding.
But during recessions?
Demand for their core services raising capital, M&A advice naturally plummets. Companies become defensive, conserve cash, avoid big moves, so their revenue streams contract significantly. Success really hinges on navigating these cycles, managing risk exceptionally well, and maintaining client confidence even when times are tough.
That really underscores why this isn't a game most individuals can play directly. You know, you or I can't just call up Goldman Sachs and say, hey, put me down for 10 grand in that next big merger you're advising on.
Right, haha. No, access to those kinds of deals. The underwriting, the M&A advisory that's reserved for the institutional players and the corporations themselves.
But it's interesting. You mentioned the stability aspect they seek through asset management. Is there a way for individual investors to tap into that kind of stability, even if they can't access the deals themselves?
Well, that's where some alternatives come into play. The idea is to replicate the characteristics of that stable, fee-based AUM model that focus on predictable long-term returns, but in a way that's accessible to the average person.
How so? What kind of alternatives are we talking about?
Instead of trying to time volatile markets or get into complex derivatives, some platforms, the sources mentioned, Gamma Assets as an example, focus on different asset classes. Specifically, things like real estate-backed opportunities.
Real estate, so investing in property.
Sort of, but often packaged differently. The idea is to offer investments tied to tangible assets, things that tend to have more intrinsic long-term value compared to, say, a fast-moving stock price. Real estate often tends to be less volatile day-to-day than the stock market.
And presumably the goal is to generate more predictable returns, more like that AUM fee stream the big banks rely on for stability.
This seems to be the aim. To provide access, often with lower minimum investment amounts, so individuals can diversify their portfolio with something that's potentially more stable and less correlated with the ups and downs of the equity markets.
So it's about accessibility and trying to capture that predictability, avoiding the really high-risk, complex fee structures tied to the deal-making side of investment banking.
Exactly. It's offering a pathway for individuals to seek a similar kind of stability that the giant investment banks themselves value so highly in their own asset management divisions, focusing on tangible assets, potentially less market volatility, and more predictable income streams.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. We've peered inside the investment banking black box. They're not like our local banks at all. They're these high-stakes financial engineers, making huge sums primarily from
taking on risk when underwriting new securities, providing exclusive expertise and access for advisory deals like M&A, making markets and sometimes big bets in trading, and managing vast sums for institutions and the wealthy for steady fees via asset management.
But it all hinges heavily on a healthy economy, confident markets, and managing enormous risks, market swings, regulations, reputation, and the economic cycle itself.
Absolutely. Their fortunes rise and fall with the broader economy to a much greater extent than commercial banks.
And for you, the listener, understanding how these massive institutions generate their wealth, it helps you see the bigger picture of global finance, right?
It does. It helps distinguish between different types of financial activity, the high-fee, high-risk world of capital formation versus potentially more stable, predictable return models. And that understanding can definitely inform smarter choices when thinking about your own personal investments and portfolio.
Definitely food for thought. So here's a final question to leave you with. We know individual investors can't really play in the same league as these banks deal-wise, but what does the fact that IBs rely so heavily on giant corporations and ultra-high net worth clients tell us about how risk, and maybe opportunity, are distributed across the entire financial system today?
That's a deep one.
Something to ponder. We'll see you on the next deep dive.